on 98 FM and online. This is Phoenix FM.
Good evening. You're listening to Body Talk here on Phoenix 98 FM with me, Mel Watson. Hope you're having a good and healthy week once again. And back with you once more with some more health tips and hints to help you through the week and hopefully through the months and years as well. Starting off with the usual news roundup and then going on to some more in-depth subjects. And yes, we're still not quite virus free, are we? Things are looking better, I think. We're kind of looking forward to life getting back to some semblance of normality. But still with the virus in the air, I'll be talking to you about how you can check if you do have a temperature and signs to look out for. But first of all, the usual news roundup. So, walking up to 12,000 steps a day reduces your risk of a premature death and lowers your blood pressure. And it's all to do with the number of steps you take and not the speed and intensity of your walking. That's according to two new studies. Although the standard step rate seems set at 10,000 and some researchers have seen little benefit beyond walking 8,000 steps a day, new research suggests that 12,000 is the optimum for increasing your chances of a long and healthy life. Looking at almost 5,000 people whose daily walking was monitored for 7 days and whose health was assessed around 12 years later, the researchers found that those walking 10,000 steps a day had a 51% lower risk of premature death compared to participants who walked only 4,000 steps a day, while the risk dropped by 65% among those who walked 12,000 steps. But the researchers at the National Cancer Institute were surprised that the intensity of the walking had little to do with any protective effects. Instead, they depended almost entirely on simply the number of steps being taken. Walking also lowers blood pressure. A separate study has found a person's systolic blood pressure reading falls an average of 0.45 points for every 1,000 steps walked. That's according to researchers from the University of California in San Francisco. So someone walking 10,000 steps a day would have a systolic blood pressure level that was 2.25 points below that of someone walking just 5,000 steps a day. The researchers tracked the blood pressure of 638 people whose average blood pressure reading was 122 mmHg over 76 mmHg, which is slightly above the normal levels that doctors like to see. But by walking, the participants could see their readings drop to safe levels, the researchers said. So that's good news, isn't it? So even if you just get out and do some walking, it's really good for you. Now, our DNA isn't an instruction book, new research suggests. Instead, it's just a list of ingredients our cells will use every so often. The real drivers that determine our health are found in the molecules that regulate a cell's DNA. That's according to the University of Maryland. DNA cannot be seen as the blueprint for life. It is at best an overlapping and potentially scrambled list of ingredients that's used differently by different cells at different times. And one good example is the colour of our eyes, which is not determined by our DNA, but by the cells associated with eye colour. Biologists have been unable to explain from reading DNA code how we get our eye shape or why we even have eyes at all. And that's because it's determined by instructions outside the DNA. Now, this theory has gathered support from other academics. The Tufts Center for Regenerative and Developmental Biology believe that the theory unlocks many puzzles about our health and development that the DNA blueprint model hasn't been able to answer. Hereditary diseases aren't a factor of genetics, and so medicine has been looking in the wrong place for answers. Instead, these diseases may have more to do with the arrangement of molecules and the way they interact with each other. Now, the pro-vaccine camp thinks it's finally found a way of reaching out to anti-vaxxers following the results of a psychological study. The study claims anti-vaxxers think differently from the rest, seeing threats and dangers that aren't as likely as they fear. Researchers from Texas Tech University say they're excited by their findings. It could end up being a way of researching this diverse group. They've asked about 150 people to estimate the likelihood of various bad experiences, ranging from an animal bite to a car crash. Those who estimated a high chance of an adverse reaction to vaccines thought there was a higher probability of other bad life experiences too. But just educating the anti-vaxxers won't work. A better way to convey the idea that vaccine risks are low needs to be found, the researchers conclude. So, who knows what they're going to find, but I think if we're all entitled to our own opinions, aren't we, at the end of the day? So maybe there's a good reason to be had for allowing to be an anti-vaxxer. You know, we're all different and we're all able to do our own things in our different ways. And it's never too late to adopt a healthier lifestyle, and it can still have a big impact on your health in later years. Women who take up a better diet in their 50s reduce their risk of a stroke 20 years later, a new study has found. The risk falls by as much as 30%, say researchers at the Harvard T.H. Chan School of Public Health in Boston, who track the health and lifestyles of nearly 60,000 women for around 26 years. The average age of the women was 52 at the start of the study, and they were urged to adopt healthier lifestyles such as giving up smoking, exercising and eating a better diet, including more fish, nuts, whole grains, fruits and vegetables, and eliminating processed meats. During the study, nearly 5% of women suffered a stroke, but the risk was dramatically reduced in those who had changed their bad habits. Although the lifestyle changes had a positive impact, the healthier diet was the most important and on its own reduced the risk of a stroke by 23%. That's got to be good news, isn't it? Healthier lifestyle. Definitely good. That's what I'm always encouraging you to do, adopting a healthier lifestyle. But something that could not be as healthy as you think is your sushi. A small worm could be inside that, if eaten, can cause nausea or vomiting. Most sushi chefs can spot the herring worm, or anisakis. It can be up to 2 centimetres in length, roughly the size of a British 5-pence coin. But they need to be increasingly vigilant, say scientists from the University of Washington, because the prevalence of the worm has increased 283-fold. That's a lot of worms, isn't it, since the 1970s. The worms are bad news for marine creatures, but they are less of a threat to human health. They can't live for more than a few days in the human intestine, although they can mimic the symptoms of food poisoning and cause vomiting or diarrhea. But the discovery won't put off one of the researchers, who apparently is regularly eating sushi and will continue to do so. But those worried about the herring worm should cut their sushi or sashimi down the middle to see if there are any present in the fish. Now, making one small change to your diet can have a big impact on your health and could even halve your chances of a premature death. Replacing just 5% of your calories from processed meat for a plant-based alternative, such as nuts or vegetables, will dramatically reduce your risk of heart disease later in life. That's according to researchers at Harvard University. And they've tracked the health and diets of around 37,000 people with an average age of 50 and discovered that those who made even smaller changes, replacing just 2% of red or processed meat for a healthier alternative, still saw their heart disease risk fall by 32%. But the biggest benefits were seen in those who replaced 5% of meat protein. And people eating an unhealthy diet of processed foods will increase their chances of developing a chronic disease such as heart problems, cancer or dementia. But it's not as simple as that. Never is it? Researchers have discovered that how we combine unhealthy food options on the same plate plays a big part in their risk of illness as the food choices we make. At the heart of the problem is processed meats such as sausages, which almost everyone who went on to develop dementia at least were eating regularly. But what they were eating with the meats seemed to affect the risk just as much, say researchers at the University of Bordeaux in France. In a study of about 200 people with dementia whose diets were compared against around 400 people without the disease, the researchers found that those most likely to develop dementia were adding starchy foods such as potatoes and snacking on baked good goods afterwards. The number of times that people ate sausages and mashed potatoes, for instance, was just as big a risk factor as eating processed meats on their own. People who ate processed meat regularly, but who accompanied it with healthier options such as vegetables, seafood or fruit, ran a smaller risk of developing dementia. Diversity is the key, according to the researchers. Include healthier options into your diet, even one centred around processed meats, reduces your chances of developing dementia. So just make sure you get a good and varied diet. I think that's the most important thing, isn't it? And healthy. Try not to eat too many packaged foods or savoury snacks and things like that. And just make sure that you get plenty of fresh fruit and vegetables. Right, we're going to take a break now. And after the break, I shall be talking to you about how to spot when you have a temperature or when you may be getting sick. So stay tuned for more after this.
I guess now it's time for me to give up. It's time. Got a picture of you beside me. Got your lipstick mark still on your coffee cup. Oh, yeah. Got a fist of pure emotion. Got a head of shattered dreams. Gotta leave it all behind now. Whatever I said, whatever I didn't mean it. I just want you back for good.
Want you back, want you back, want you back for good.
Whenever I'm wrong, just tell me the song and I'll sing it. You'll be right and understood.
Want you back, want you back,
I want you back for good. Unaware but underlined, I figured out the story. Wasn't good,
no, no.
But in a corner of my mind,
corner of my mind,
I celebrated glory.
But that was not to be.
In the twist of separation, you excelled at being free.
Can't you find
a little room inside for me?
community radio for Brentwood and Billericay. This is Phoenix FM.
Welcome back. You're listening to Body Talk here on Phoenix 98 FM with me, Mel Watson. And yes, we're not quite virus free yet, are we? We're getting there, but we're not quite there at the moment. So how to tell? How can we tell if we're starting to get sick? I mean, I know we've got lots of clues as to what the virus might be giving us, but fever is one of the major telltale signs of infection with coronavirus, and when we come down with an infection, our temperature can rise as part of our immune response to kill it off. Now, the rise is triggered by chemical messengers released by immune cells travelling to the hypothalamus, the part of the brain that controls temperature, telling it to increase the heat within your body, known as the core temperature. And most of our lives, our body temperature hovers around 37 degrees, between 36.5 degrees centigrade and 37.5 degrees centigrade. So it's classed as a fever if it goes over 37.8 degrees centigrade. Now, viruses are more likely to die off when the temperature goes above 38 degrees centigrade. So not only does a high temperature directly kill the virus, it also triggers a cascade of responses in the body that fire up immunity. For example, a temperature above 37 degrees centigrade can speed up the activity of NFKB proteins in our cells, which turn on genes involved in the immune response. That's according to a 2018 study from the University of Warwick. Other research has shown that specific virus-killing cells, T cells, also rev up their activity when temperature rises. There is a belief that lowering the temperature may delay getting better and prolong illness. Saying that, though, fevers can be serious, so seek the advice of a GP, particularly with babies and young children. So what we need to do is to kind of work out what's normal for us. So our body temperatures naturally fluctuate over the day and through the night. And one study based on readings from more than 300 people found its lowest between 3 a.m. and 5 a.m. and highest between 4 p.m. and 6 p.m. with a difference of about half a degree Celsius between the two times. That's according to US researchers who wrote in the Journal of General Internal Medicine. This suggests that if you want to take a baseline temperature, first thing in the morning is the best time to measure. However, doctors have noticed that temperature may spike on and off throughout the day in those sick with coronavirus. And although it's not yet known why this might be. So if you're concerned, take more than one temperature reading a day, say morning and afternoon. And if you think you may be infected, keep an eye on other symptoms, for example, a dry cough, loss of smell or taste and tiredness. And if they become more severe, call 111. But younger women with a normal body weight tend to have a higher body temperature than older men who are overweight. That's according to a study that was published in the Journals of Gerontology, which analysed the body temperatures of more than 18,000 people. The analysis also found men were generally colder than women, with scientists suggesting female hormones may play a role, as temperature tends to fall after menopause and is known to fluctuate during the menstrual cycle. It's also found that women in their 20s had an average body temperature of 36.5 degrees centigrade, while the women in their 80s had an average of 36.1 degrees centigrade. In men, a similar drop was found, and it's not known why it happens, but the body generally slows down as we get older, and this may be reflected in the temperature. So it is thought that coronavirus can live on hard surfaces such as plastic for up to 72 hours, if not longer. So right now, you shouldn't be sharing thermometers to take your temperature, even at home between family members. But if you only have one at home, you can wash the end of an oral thermometer with soap and water, or wipe it down with an alcohol antimicrobial wipe if you have them. And with an ear thermometer, the best solution is to use disposable tips. So, yeah. It's just take care when sharing anything these days, but particularly something like a thermometer is going to be probing into spaces that that we don't normally go, isn't it? So just take care with that. Now, also, the more someone weighed, the higher their average temperature was, and why exactly this should be so is unclear. But one theory is that inflammatory chemicals released by fat could be the cause of the increased temperature. Now, another fascinating theory is a lower body temperature may be associated with living longer. It's been shown that lowering body temperature in mice increases lifespan by around 20%. As well as this lower baseline temperature in older people, their immune systems don't trigger such intense responses to infections. As such, older people may not always develop a fever in response to infection. This means you shouldn't rely on the presence of a high temperature as the only sign of infection, and people should pay extra attention to other symptoms such as pain, cough or breathlessness, and unusual levels of confusion. And the most accurate body temperature reading, often used in intensive care units, comes from using a rectal thermometer, as it measures inside the body rather than on the periphery. But you're probably not wanting to use this at home, so the next best option is in the ear, which takes the temperature of the tympanic membrane or the eardrum. Now, the eardrum shares the same blood supply as the hypothalamus, so it gives a good idea of what's happening internally. Ear thermometers use an infrared light to measure energy coming off the eardrum, but they don't test the temperature in the ear, so if you've been lying on it, this can lead to higher readings if the ear is warm. So use the other ear instead, then stick with that ear when measuring throughout the day to get the most accurate assessment of changes in body temperature. Ear thermometers also shouldn't be used if you have an ear infection, as the ear will already be hot due to inflammation. And if you do have to use an oral thermometer, avoid using it within 20 to 30 minutes of a hot or cold drink, food, exercise or smoking. This is because all of these can temporarily raise temperature in the mouth, and in the case of exercise, throughout the body. So leave the thermometer under the tongue for 1 or 2 minutes and try to stay still for the most accurate reading. Despite the convenience, forehead strips or taking temperature in the armpit are believed to be the least accurate, as they are truly external. If you do have to take a temperature under the arm, add 1 degree centigrade to the figure to get a more accurate reading. So there are lots of different ways to take your temperature, isn't there, really? And lots of different ways in which it can be changed as well. And stress can cause a rise in body temperature, a condition that's called psychogenic fever. It's most common in children and adolescents, with an analysis by researchers in Japan in 2007 finding that stress or psychological and emotional agitation accounted for 18% of unexplained cases of fever in children. And contrary to popular belief, you don't necessarily feel hot if you have a fever. This is one of the big misconceptions about high temperatures. If you feel hot, you almost certainly don't have a fever, more likely a cold. When we have a fever, we usually feel cold and shivery and want to wrap ourselves up. You do, however, feel hot to touch, so feeling the forehead with the back of a hand is actually a very good way to tell whether you have a fever if you don't have a thermometer. And if your skin feels cold, you almost certainly don't have a fever. There's lots of different ways there of telling whether or not you have a fever, or whether you're prone to get a fever as well. It's interesting, isn't it? It's so difficult to tell, though. And I know it's, when we get colds, when we get flu viruses, things like that, it's very difficult to tell how serious they are, and particularly in these troubling times as well. But taking your temperature and keeping a check of your temperature is probably one of the best things that you can do. And yes, who knows where we're going to end up with this virus, but there's new research being done all the time. But apparently tiny antibodies found in alpacas could help suppress a second wave of the virus and allow countries to safely lift lockdown. They come up with new things all the time, don't they? Scientists in Sweden and South Africa have used nanobodies from an animal immunised against the virus to protect it from binding or infecting a human being. And the small antibody targets the spikes of the virus, which in turn interferes with its ability to infect its hosts. Now, the experts have claimed that their research potentially neutralises the virus. Due to the fact that nanobodies are cheap and easy to reproduce, they could be a widely accessible option. And they're a lot easier to clone and change, according to the scientists. So the current coronavirus pandemic has drastic consequences for the world's population. And any research like this is desperately needed, isn't it? But neutralising antibodies can block virus entry at an early step of infection and potentially protect individuals that are at high risk of developing severe disease. So, of course, none of this research is confirmed as yet, so we will wait for more news. But there are new developments coming all the time in this, aren't there? And it's amazing. I mean, there's so much research being done even as we speak. So hopefully I'll be able to keep you up to date with bits and pieces as they surface. Right, we're going to have a little break now, and after the break I'll be back talking about how you can keep your energy levels up. Very important, isn't it, in these unprecedented times? So stay tuned for more after this.
You sure do. Come on, baby.
Community Radio for Brentwood and Billericay. This is Phoenix FM.
Welcome back. You're listening to Body Talk here on Phoenix 98 FM with me, Mel Watson. Yes, keeping your energy levels up is very important, isn't it? At any time, but particularly at these times, I think many people are feeling quite lethargic, not very keen on getting back to work after having had so much time off, etc. So what can we do to keep our energy levels up? Well, there's certain things we should be doing and certain things that are actually myths. Do you really need coffee to function in the morning? Can you catch up on lost sleep at weekends? Well, maybe not. There are many nutritional, biochemical and emotional processes that contribute to whether or not we feel energized throughout the day. But just getting on top of that feeling of tiredness isn't as simple as you think. So one of the main things that people think of is coffee. They need a coffee to wake them up. And most people think that they need a big hit of caffeine first thing in the morning. And it's what gets you through the day of stress and meetings and clients, etc. But it's a self-fulfilling prophecy, because coffee often leads to people feeling like they need more caffeine or sugar to get through the day. So you get that hit and then you get the energy drop, don't you? Often people are shocked by how much more energy they have without relying on caffeine. Now, our bodies have an amazing ability to create extraordinary energy when our energy systems are supported by our lifestyle choices. If you are someone who drinks caffeine, the biochemists have recommended that you try to cut out the amount you have in half each week until you don't have any at all. Then after 2 weeks with no caffeine, take note of how you feel. And while you might have felt tired at first due to the caffeine withdrawal, you should feel a bit better as your energy increases naturally. You could always replace the habit with a cup of herbal tea. So it's not that you shouldn't have a drink, because I think it's always important to keep your water levels, you know, to keep hydrated, keep your water levels high through the day, but maybe not so much reliant on the caffeine. Now, if you think you're not a breakfast person and it doesn't agree with you to eat first thing in the morning, then you're not alone. But it's a complete myth to think this way, as not eating breakfast is only likely to lead you feeling ravenous by mid-morning and more likely to eat something that isn't good for you. Try starting your day with something nourishing to keep your energy levels consistent throughout the morning and improve your cognitive function. Now, if you really feel as though you can't eat as soon as you wake up, then maybe consider why that could be the case. For example, you could be eating too late in the evening, and that is a common problem. If you have your meal too late in the evening, then it will just sit in your stomach and not digest properly. So it's much better to eat earlier in the evening. And also, if you do eat earlier in the evening, it does mean that you're less likely to be troubled by your tummy through the night and less likely to wake up, etc., and have problems. So you will get a better night's rest if you do eat earlier in the evening, that's without a doubt. And many people associate tiredness with iron deficiency, and while that is true, there are also other nutrients which are good for your health. For example, without the consumption of sufficient B vitamins, the pathways that are responsible for the conversion of food into energy can be inefficient, leaving us feeling sluggish and tired. You should also concentrate on getting plenty of iodine in order to avoid an underactive thyroid. And the best diet is a varied one, filled with plenty of plants and leafy green vegetables. You should pay attention to your body and how it feels after you eat certain foods. And certainly if you're feeling sluggish after a meal, then maybe avoid having that meal, or maybe not eating quite as much. I mean, we should always be thinking about what response our body has had to certain foods. Generally, we tend to think in our head, but if we think afterwards, how does my body feel now that I've eaten this particular thing? Do I feel tired? Do I feel lethargic? Do I feel miserable? Do I feel angry? You know, all sorts of things like that can happen after you've eaten certain foods. So it is really good to try and pay attention to your mood, your food mood. Really important. Now, if you feel tired and lacking in energy, often the easiest thing to do is reach for a bar of chocolate or a biscuit to act as a quick pick-me-up. But while you might think the sugar hit will give you a rush of energy, this will lead to a crash and then an energy roller coaster for the rest of the day. So including more good quality fats from whole foods will typically provide more lasting, sustained energy and help to prevent the cravings for more sugary foods and drinks that can arise when our energy dips low. Opt for raw nuts and seeds and extra virgin olive oil when you can to stay full and feeling full as well, not really wanting anything else. It's quite difficult, isn't it? It's so easy to reach for a bag of sweets or a packet of crisps or something like that just to keep you going. But really, you should be opting for something that's much healthier. It will keep you feeling fuller for longer. And obviously, it will boost your energy levels because it's much better for your body and probably help control your weight too. So just be aware of that when you're choosing your next snack. And people who go to bed a bit late during the week or at the weekend, try to catch up later. Does this actually work? Well, we need between 7 and 9 hours of sleep a night, and we can't catch up by getting more later. So if you aim for closer to the 9 hour mark, if you can, as some studies suggest, we need this much for our bodies to be able to undergo all of their vital repair work. That will be much better for you. So, some people are thinking, my goodness, 9 hours, I can only sleep a few. But it's the patterns that we get into as well, isn't it? We kind of expect to be sleeping for just a few hours each night, so therefore we do. But is this doing us any good in the long run? Possibly not. We need to really track every aspect of what we're doing and work out whether it's making us feel better or worse. So if something isn't making you feel good, then maybe it's time to change it. And some people say that watching TV at night makes you more relaxed. And actually, quite the opposite is true, because the blue light emitted from screens disrupts our natural circadian rhythms and makes us feel more awake, even if we're exhausted. And the experts say you should turn off all devices 90 minutes before you intend to go to sleep and instead read a book or magazine, and your sleep will be deeper and longer as a result of this. Well, I think everybody's different, and yes, that is one point of view, and that will be the response for certain people. But I fall asleep in front of the TV all the time. I don't think the blue light is keeping me awake. Maybe a stronger blue light is needed to keep me awake through the evening, because sometimes it's so easy just to have that evening snooze. And it's bad as well, because falling asleep in front of the TV like that, you fall asleep for an hour or so and then you wake up wide awake, don't you? And then you can't go to bed and go to sleep at the proper time. So blue light, I know, is bad. It's proven to be bad from you, but I think sometimes it's all too easy to fall asleep in front of the TV, isn't it? And we upset our body clocks by doing that. Our circadian rhythm is definitely disrupted by that evening snooze, or that early evening snooze. So it is very important to keep your energy levels up and to look after yourself. And, you know, during these difficult times as well, we've suffered in all sorts of ways, and all sorts of things I think are going to kind of surface once we come through this pandemic. And in fact, the well-being of almost 8 million Britons was affected by loneliness caused by the government's coronavirus lockdown. That's according to official data. And a survey by the Office for National Statistics of more than 5,500 people suggested 14.3% of the population, or 7.4 million people, have suffered loneliness in the past 7 days. Statisticians, it's a difficult word to say, isn't it? Statisticians revealed this group of people, dubbed the lockdown lonely, tend to be young, single or divorced and renting. Half of those aged 16 to 24 were affected by lockdown loneliness, according to the survey, compared to just a quarter of those around their 60s. Separate findings of the same survey carried out on 5,000 Brits revealed 5% were chronically lonely and admitted they felt alone often or always. The data from the Opinions and Lifestyle Survey was collected from April the 3rd to May the 3rd and involved just over 5,000 adults. And everyone in the survey was asked, how often do you feel lonely? And 5% said that they were suffering chronic loneliness, which means they are lonely often or always, and not just in the past 7 days. And this equates to 2.6 million people across Great Britain. So I think there is a huge issue with our connections with each other, and and how we feel. It's and I think maybe this is a problem that's been being ignored. I think many people have been feeling quite lonely for many, many years, which is rather a troubling state, isn't it? Okay, we're going to have a little break now, and after the break I'll be back with you talking a little bit more about the nation's mental health and how we can help ourselves through these times. So stay tuned for more after this.
So can we talk about last night, quarter to midnight, when we started dancing? Too many drinks to see clearly. Then we crossed that line too far this time.
Twice I got your answer phone. Yeah, it's easy to ignore. Oh, but we just gotta talk. So could you pick up when I call? I won't take all your time. Just give me longer minute. Tell me what's on your mind. What you feel you're right. What happened was insane. Won't ever be the same. So can we talk about
Radio for Brentwood and Billericay. This is Phoenix FM.
Welcome back. Listening to Body Talk here on Phoenix 98 FM. And the nation's mental health, I think that's at the forefront of many people's minds at the moment. The lockdown and the coronavirus pandemic has been tough for everybody. But a leading mental health charity has released a survey to show the extent the last few months has had on the nation's mental health. Mind says that the government needs to plan how we can recover from this mental health crisis. In a survey of 16,000 people during lockdown, 2 out of 3, which is 65% of adults over 25, and 3/4, 75% of young people aged 13 to 24 with an existing mental health problem reported worse mental health. More than 1 in 5 adults, that's 22%, with no previous experience of poor mental health, now say that their mental health is poor or very poor. People said not being able to see family, loneliness, not being able to go outside, concerns about the virus itself, and boredom all contributed to the decline in their mental health. Although lockdown is now easing, the charity says that many of the underlying issues won't change and more people could be struggling due to unemployment and financial difficulties predicted as the economy tries to recover after the pandemic. Mines said that there will be a prolonged worsening of well-being and waiting lists for access to NHS mental health services will get worse, seeing an increase in the numbers of people experiencing longer-term mental health problems as well. The charity also highlights that people living in social housing are more likely to have poor mental health and to have seen it get worse during the pandemic. Over half, 52% of people living in social housing said their mental health was poor or very poor, and over two-thirds say that their mental health got worse during lockdown. Over half of under 18s who receive free school meals said their mental health was poor or very poor, versus 41% not receiving free school meals, with three-quarters of this group saying that it got worse during lockdown. When it came to those struggling with work, those who were unemployed and seeking work during the pandemic were more likely to have lower well-being scores and worse mental health than those who were in employment. People who were furloughed, changed jobs or lost their job due to coronavirus saw their mental health and well-being decline more than those whose employment status didn't change, with three-quarters reporting lower than average well-being scores. The charity wants the government to do five things as part of its recovery plan for mental health: investing in community services, protecting those most at risk, and addressing inequalities faced by people from Black, Asian, and other minority ethnic communities, reforming the Mental Health Act, providing a financial safety net through the benefits system, and supporting children and young people. Now, the chief executive of Mind has said the coronavirus pandemic is, as such, a mental health emergency as it is a physical one. The devastating loss of life, the impact of lockdown, and the inevitable recession that lies ahead will leave a deep and lasting scar on our nation's mental health. Those of us who were already struggling with our mental health have fared worse, but we also know that many people who were previously well will now develop mental health problems as a direct consequence of the pandemic. We have been calling on successive UK governments to put mental health at the heart of the policy and political agenda, and there has never been a more critical time than it is now. As we look to the future, those in power should make the right choices to rebuild services and support, and to ensure that the society comes after the pandemic is kinder, fairer and safer for everyone experiencing a mental health problem. This can only be achieved by putting mental health at the very centre of the UK government's recovery plans, not only in relation to the NHS, but across all domestic departments. So the Department of Health and Social Care spokesman said that they recognise the impact that this unprecedented global pandemic can have on people's mental health, and NHS mental health services have remained open, delivering support online and over the phone. And they did publish guidance at the beginning of lockdown to provide advice on steps individuals can take to support their well-being and manage mental health. And they've also awarded £4.2 million to mental health and wellbeing charities like Samaritans, Young Minds and Bipolar UK. That is in addition to £5 million already made available to charities through the coronavirus mental health response. So there is something that's being done, but I think what Mind is saying is that it's not enough. And I think the fallout from what we've experienced over these past few months is going to be going on for a long time yet. And I think part of the problem is what experts are describing as quarantine fatigue. And I was talking about keeping your energy levels up earlier on, and you might think, well, we've had all this time to rest, we've had all this time at home doing nothing, so why would we need to keep our energy levels up? We should be perfectly okay. But there is this thing called quarantine fatigue. After spending weeks at home trying to reduce the spread of COVID-19, in some cases only to find infections surging again, you might be experiencing what experts have called quarantine fatigue. It can manifest in many forms, including lack of appetite, sleep issues and anxiety, all stemming from the COVID-19 pandemic. Now, tips for fighting quarantine fatigue are strikingly similar to general self-care. So if you're looking after yourself, then, you know, some of the things that I mentioned earlier as well will be really good for you. But we know sometimes it's easier said than done. But try to think of it as an opportunity to focus on things that you wouldn't typically have time for, whether that's reconnecting with friends and family or practicing self-care. Just changing your mindset can often have a positive effect. And to get through quarantine fatigue, the best thing to do is just to put a different spin on it. Look at each day as a gift of time. Give yourself a set schedule every day, including sleeping at typical times, eating regular meals and getting in some exercise. When so much of the world around you is chaotic, keeping some sense of structure in your life can be helpful. And obviously, as I was saying earlier, get enough sleep. It's your best friend. A lack of proper sleep can increase your stress levels, so it's important to make sure you're getting enough of it. To protect your sleep, go to bed at a set time each evening. Lower lighting levels a few hours before sleep. Avoid caffeine and sugar after three, and keep technology out of your bedroom. You know, it's all basic stuff, good basic advice. Now, hobbies is another thing that many people seem to have been taking up at this time. And you've probably seen lots of your friends and doing things on social media. But it's the perfect time now to dive into something that you've been meaning to try. It can give your brain something else to focus on, so you're less concerned about the things in the world that you can't control. And limit your time on social media and other forms of technology if it's starting to weigh on you. If you're feeling stressed by too many Zoom sessions, phone calls or text, just let people know that you need some time out to protect your sanity. But don't feel that you have to step away if you don't want to, because you also need human interaction while you're practicing your social distancing. So keep in touch as much as your stress levels will allow. So it's finding balance again, isn't it, in all things. And I'm sure you know by now how good exercise is for you, and the benefits for so-called quarantine fatigue are no different. Whether you take a time out to stretch, practice kickboxing, taking the dog for a walk or doing an online yoga class, frequent exercise is a surefire way to boost your mood. And neurobiologically, staying home can trigger the body's stress response. And when stress becomes chronic, as it can when we're in lockdown, the resulting elevated levels of cortisol and adrenaline damage both mental and physical health. So it's so important right now to stay mindful and breathe through it all. So take some time each day to just quietly relax, be with yourself. Think positive thoughts, and just having this mental shift can calm anxiety. And if you feel like the stress related to COVID-19 is getting too much for you, don't be afraid to reach out for help, whether that's to family, friends or a mental health professional. Someone will listen and someone will be there to support you. So, yeah, never be afraid to ask for help. And I think that's even more important than ever in these times. And another thing that seems to have come to the fore recently is a lack of vitamin D. And that could be one thing that's that we're all of us lacking. We don't make enough. I know we've been out in the sun quite a lot just recently, but it still might mean that we're lacking in our vitamin D. Vitamin D is important. A deficiency could cause tiredness, bone pain, fractures, muscle weakness, cramps, mood changes. Insufficient levels, you know, means that we don't have enough to be optimally healthy. But we may need more than we think as well. So a vitamin D deficiency can be fatal in itself. So it's crucial to fix low levels of vitamin D before they turn into a deficiency. However, doing it can be tricky. You only tend to get clear-cut signs when you're severely lacking in it. But there might be general signs that your body isn't working optimally because of low vitamin levels. These could be low immune system, such as finding you pick up colds and infections very easily, not recovering very well from exercise, struggling to sleep and feeling tired. And if you haven't been exposed to a lot of sunlight, you're probably right to assume you'll be low in vitamin D. In the UK and northern latitudes, especially during winter, we're almost all of us insufficient. But even though it's summer, we should still all be conscious of how little vitamin D we're exposed to, especially at the beginning of lockdown when we could only leave the house for an hour a day. We wouldn't have been getting enough sun on us. So wear sun cream when you're outside, but that does block the absorption of sunlight and the amount of vitamin D we can make. So maybe in the meantime, we could be taking a vitamin D supplement, and there are many available, but do make sure that you have a good quality vitamin D supplement. Okay, so hopefully that's given you some hints and tips on how to stay fit and healthy in these current times. It's been great being with you once again this week. So until this time next week, take care of your body and take care of yourself.
you seem just like a breath. No choice, your voice can take me there.